This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, here with a very special episode. Today's conversation is with a woman who's written a book that you all have recommended to me so very many times, and I am so grateful for it. It turns out she was a listener of the podcast and has been for a while, which exploded my whole brain with happiness, and we finally connected and had one of the most fascinating conversations that I've had for this podcast. We got along incredibly well, talked about kind of everything, but I think you're all going to really enjoy it and it's going to really resonate. We talked about the goddesses and kind of what they mean to us, how they interact with each other, how to write about them today, and how you can kind of examine that. A lot to do with how to approach the goddesses today. We talked about women in general, women as monsters, Medusa specifically, of course. We talked about feminism in the world that we're in of classical reception and kind of everything that comes along with that, including the misogyny. We talked about our own intersectional feminism and everything that kind of surrounds that and how we both approach our storytelling. We talked about colonialism in Greek mythology and in life and how Medusa is representative of that. Things I've never considered before, had my brain kind of expanding, and oh my gosh, I'm just very excited for you all to hear this conversation. I do want to say that at one point we go into a bit of a rant about men on the internet and men in person rather, and at one point it's a little too late into the conversation that I realize we should clarify that we are referring to cisgendered heterosexual men, I always find my brain automatically assumes that people will know that that's who I'm referring to, because it tends to be that if men are causing me grief on the internet or in life, they are cisgender hetero. And so I tend to take that as an assumption, and I realize I shouldn't. And so to clarify, you can just assume that our complaints are geared towards them. Honestly, I absolutely love this conversation. We talked for a lot longer than I'm giving you now, so there are a couple little transitions in between where I'd cut out chunks that devolved into personal conversations or things like that. But ultimately, we had an absolutely incredible, super fascinating conversation that I know you're all going to just love. So, with those little pieces of information and caveats out of the way, I give you this very special episode. This is episode 104, Medusa, Colonialism, Reimagining Goddesses and Monsters with Nikita Gill. Nikita Gill, author of, amongst other things, The Great Goddesses, which is just so exciting. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited. This is one of my favorite podcasts, so I'm so happy.
That still fully blows my mind. Actually, your book was gifted to me by a listener of the podcast, and I read it when I first got it, and then, you know, it's been a couple of years now almost, and I went back to it before we were chatting, and I guess the person had actually gone into the shop to buy it versus doing it online, because she'd like handwritten this note on the bookmark in it that I didn't remember. And I know, it was so sweet. I think her name was Chloe. Of course, I left the bookmark across the room, but I'll edit this in case I got it wrong. But it was like, I couldn't stop thinking of you while I was reading this book, so I had to give you one. It's just so lovely.
Oh, my readers are sweethearts. Like, I'm telling you, I know, like, a lot of authors must say this about their readers, but I swear to God, I have the kindest audience. Like, they just... when we used to be able to meet people at your readings and stuff, people would come to me and tell me like these beautiful stories about how they found my books and how the books helped them. And like, I'd just be sitting there like a puddle of tears going, really? It means that much to you?
I equally have just the absolute nicest listeners in the world, and I think we have a lot of crossover because of our content, so it makes sense. We have just equally lovely people.
I love that, especially because it's funny, like, writing this book felt so much like writing a love letter to the gods in so many ways. And then after the book, like I said to you on DMs, I feel like I learned a lot, because a lot of really amazing classicists kind of reached out to me to talk to me about the book, and even about the content, that they were like, oh, this is slightly problematic because, you know, this, that, and the other. And it was really nice to learn from them as opposed to just learning from books. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Especially because classics, the books that you read are written predominantly by men, and like the translations are also by men, and like, so you don't even realize how problematic it is until someone else explains to you that, I know you thought what you did in this, and it's one particular myth, it's the Persephone myth, right? Yeah. Where Demeter is like the mother who kind of stifles her, and Persephone chooses her own path. And I went in because my mom is a bit like stifling. I really went down that route so much because I was like, I get that. I get the idea of choosing your own path and like becoming this like queen of hell. And that really appealed to me. But then someone reached out to me who is a classicist and who's amazing. And she was like, I don't know whether you realize how misogynistic that interpretation of is to Demeter. And I didn't think. And it was really humbling to like sit there and listen and go, oh, you're right. You're absolutely right. And the idea of taking away the survival aspect of Persephone, that she was a survivor of a lot of trauma of that kidnapping, and going, no, she chose that. you're taking away a narrative from survivors. And as a survivor, that really clicked with me. And I think that learning process is so important when you read or do anything with the classics, you know, and being able to go, yeah, I messed up. I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you're describing so many experiences I've had doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. For me, it's always just been a lot of growth in terms of how I tell the stories and what I focus on. And even just, I think for me too, like I did my degree in classics, but I didn't really intend to use it. And so I didn't dive too deeply into things. Mm. And then now I'm doing this, and I started out really like base level, just like overview of the stories. And then now, of course, you know, like I'm 4 years in and I'm reading as many books as I can possibly find on a story in order to tell it. And, you know, something that would have taken me one episode at the beginning is taking me 4 or 5 episodes now. And so for me, it's the same kind of level of like constant learning and taking in all this new information. But I just go like, I have to make it the most accurate thing in the world. And all these different sources say all these different things, and all the, you know, and it's of course it's almost impossible to do accuracy in Greek myth.
Oh, absolutely. It's a living thing. Can't do it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just, you know, you can't really. And so it's such a fascinating thing. Even, you know, I wrote my book in June. And since then I've learned so much that I already wish I could go back and change like all these different things, including even something as basic as there's like a further reading section at the back of my book with book suggestions. And I'm like, oh my God, I missed all these incredible books I should have suggested.
Oh, I feel you. Like I wish there's so much with Greek goddesses that I wish I could go back. Mainly it is the Persephone and Demeter kind of bit. But I really liked that poem that I wrote where Demeter was like, you know, essentially, F you, Hades, you gave me back my daughter. How dare you? That was that poem. When I look back at it now, I'm like, well, she was telling me in the poem that came out of me that this is how she feels. And I didn't honor that. That's such a strange way to put it. But like, I think you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. That's fascinating. It's not strange at all. I feel like that means so much on my end as well. I think Demeter is such a complex character, and so I mean that poem clearly you kind of got exactly, I don't want to say right, but it's also the only word I can think of.
Yeah.
But how would you reapproach some of the other Persephone bits, do you think?
I think I would make more space for the fact that she is a survivor, like she was kidnapped, and like her father arranged that kidnapping, right?
Yes.
And also there's a version of the myth that talks about how Zeus actually did rape Persephone. Mm-hmm. You know. And Zeus is very much the misogynistic, archetypical, like, god who's like, I'm in control of everything, I control all the things. There are nuances to him as well, of course, but like, I feel like the way that he has treated women it's been very consistent all through myth, right?
Yes. I would say he's overall the most, like, there's nuances, but there's not that much.
Like, you can't make excuses for him kind of thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there's, he is the way that he is. And a lot of what he does is quite unforgivable. And I feel like that arranging or trafficking of Persephone, because that's what it was. That was trafficking.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah.
And like in today's terms, that's what we would call it. And then this poor mother, like what happens to the victim of trafficking's mother? Mm-hmm. Right? Like if you see Demeter through a lens of that, it's heartbreaking.
It really is. And one thing I find interesting, and I learned a bit more about it in my recent chat with Dr. Ellie Mackin Roberts, about Persephone. And I learned so many fascinating things in that talk, but specifically this idea that, you know, we see it that way. It was abduction. It was Zeus sanctioned abduction, but because it was Zeus sanctioned from like a almost legal point of view back then, or the way they would have understood all of that, it was okay.
Yeah.
It was permitted. Mm. And there is kind of an interpretation of Demeter that isn't kind of Demeter, but it is also based in the patriarchy and based in the world of ancient Greece, not so much the character of Demeter, that she was a little bit more angry that she hadn't been consulted on this quote unquote arranged marriage versus the actual, you know, thoughts for Persephone.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily, I do think Demeter as a character it's more suggestive that she would have cared, you mm-hmm. know, on a more personal mm-hmm. level. But that's fascinating in itself too, right? Yeah. Because Zeus was Persephone's father, and therefore it was his right
yeah.
to give her to Hades, which is revolting,
yeah. Yeah.
but an extra kind of level to it.
Yeah, almost like you have disrespected my position in the hierarchy as opposed to you did this to my daughter.
Exactly.
That's so
yeah.
fascinating. It really is. Greek myth is constantly, it constantly surprises me. I think,
yeah.
and like, what's really great about it is that having discussions with other people who love the myths or who are classicists or who have an interest, and you learn new things about it all the time. And I think that's the most important thing about this, isn't it? You keep like this really open mind and go, I have things to learn. I love that. I love that, that this has taught me how to do that so much more. That's what this book taught me how to do. It's like, listen more, if that makes mm. sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel so similarly when it comes to the podcast, just because of how much I've grown, but also how much I have taken in, and I'm constantly learning a new thing that I then want to express somehow and change what I've done in the past or
yeah,
yeah, it's fascinating. One thing that really stood out to me in the book is Medusa, because obviously I love Medusa.
Her.
She's
I
just the
her.
Best, but the poem specifically about the Gorgons and like the idea of the Gorgons, I feel like you basically put into a beautiful poem the way my brain constantly wants to explain Medusa, and essentially like deconstructed all the fights I've gotten into on Twitter with like shitty misogynists who hate Medusa, which I have a habit of doing. But you know, so often it comes up on Twitter so much, and I don't know if you've heard my conversation about this exact thing as well. Yeah. But it, you know, men have this really weird desire on Twitter to like not let women like Medusa.
Yeah.
It's creepy and bizarre and comes up so often. But, and so my newest thing to goad them basically, because it's fun, is there really isn't a lot of description of her monstrosity. There is some description of Gorgon monstrosity, but even that is debatable. But in terms of Medusa, you know, until they started actually depicting her in imagery, and even then, you know, it's nothing crazy. She's just described as a woman, essentially. Mm, like, yes, she's named a Gorgon, so she, you know, she's not mortal.
Yeah.
But it's in the same way that, like, the Fates aren't mortal, or the Muses aren't mortal, and you're like, well, none of them are monstrous. It's
yeah.
just a new word, Gorgon. And I find that fascinating, the idea that she has become monstrous because of, you know, all the different things about her as a character, and less so because she was actually ever meant to be that way in the, you know, the original, like, archaic forms of the myths.
She's a fascinating. I feel so awful for Medusa. Like, the way that she is, what I look at her and think of is colonization. I look at her and think that she is colonized, and she is abused, and she is every, like, things are taken from her, and she fights back, and then she's killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
literally what happens to her, and it's heartbreaking. But if that isn't a metaphor for womanhood, then I don't know what is, you know? Like,
yeah.
the minute you start fighting back, you become a monster. That's what you are. You're a monster. You're not defending yourself. You're a monster. You're going
you're
out
monster.
Of your box, which
yeah.
is probably where that you know, misogynistic men come in, because they also see it, but like, they see it on a subconscious level, whilst we see it on a conscious level. You know what I mean? And their
yeah.
instant thing is like, how dare you? How dare you like this creature? You must be a man-hating feminist, is what I get when I defend Medusa.
Yes. Yes. It's so crazy, because you can have all of your rational arguments based in contextual, like, primary sources,
yeah.
and the way that they will bend over backwards to say that that's wrong. I had a guy, and I knew I should have stopped responding at some point, but it was
yeah.
so hard to, because it was so absurd, and I always feel the need to defend her.
Mm-hmm.
And I had somebody who went into all these crazy details and for one kept changing his argument because he clearly didn't have an argument. But at one point was like, of course she's a monster. She terrorized the lands for millennia or generations. And I was like, in what story or pottery or anything? Give me one primary example where she terrorized anything. She literally lived at the ends of the earth. Perseus had to travel to the ends of the earth to get her. She was doing nothing. There's no example of her causing any trouble whatsoever. There is literally, Medusa was a Gorgon. She either slept with or was assaulted by Poseidon. I always err on the side of assaulted because it's Poseidon, let alone a god in general. And she had snakes for hair and Perseus killed her. And you're like, that's the whole story, basically. Like, there are variations, and Ovid obviously gives us this, like, stunning telling that adds a lot of detail that isn't necessarily in the original Greek extant sources. But that's it. Like, it's literally, like, she was a Gorgon and Perseus killed her. That's it.
There's this section in Natalie Haynes's new book, Pandora's Jar, where she has a whole chapter on Medusa. And there's something, and it really, I can't forget that paragraph, basically, where she talks about Perseus and she says, this is after Perseus has killed her and he's got Medusa's head, right? And he basically takes care of the head with far more care than anyone has ever cared for Medusa in her life. That because it's useful to him. That's the only reason he cares, and he like places it carefully and he looks after it and he makes sure it never goes. And I looked at all of that and I was like, oh my God, even in death, the only way that this woman is cared about is through her uses to men.
Yeah.
Wow. And it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart because I know she's fictional, but she is such a metaphor for every survivor and what we go through.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how do you, like, when you have survived sexual assault, you don't just, like, heal from it because you are accused again and again of, like, making it up. You're gaslit. You're told that, where's your evidence? You're told... Everyone knows, and I refuse to believe that even the people who ask for this don't know. It is very hard to prove sexual assault. Like,
yeah,
it really is. It's very hard. Like, women have gone in and had rape kits done, and there have been lawyers who've been able to prove in court, despite the fact that there was an actual rape kit, there was trauma, there were all sorts of terrible things happening to this woman. They've been able to say that, no, she wanted it that way. And the guy's gone free. And I look at Medusa's story and that's what I see, you know?
Yeah. No, completely. She has surpassed fiction, I think, you know, like, she's fictional, but she is so much now. She is everything you just said that I think she's gone beyond fiction in a way that not a lot of other characters have. And I mean, I personally will defend her to the death, even though she was fictional.
Yeah, because I think we all see a bit of ourselves in her because we've all experienced that. I find it very hard to argue with men online. I find them far too emotional and you know, they kind of go into these, like, they go into histrionics about the most ridiculous things. Like, you know, none of it is based in fact, you know. Very few of them will bring facts to the table. Most of them is just like, no, how dare this woman like speak over me? That's the attitude that they have. So I understand, like, because I've had this argument with men online and like this whole Medusa terrorized so many people. I'm like, you mean the people who invaded her cave to come and kill her? Are we like, what?
Yeah. And even that's like a bit of a modern understanding of her too. Like there's no story of anyone beyond Perseus.
No.
That argument is valid too, because, you know, you have to kind of argue her in a modern context where you do have this kind of idea that she was surrounded by stone sculptures of men who had tried to kill her. And I like that idea too, frankly.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
But there's absolutely no evidence that she caused anyone harm whatsoever. Not a single lick of it.
Like, the evidence in itself is that she never left that temple.
Yeah.
She didn't leave.
She literally went to the ends of the earth. Like, the way it's described is because obviously they believed that the earth had an end. And she lived at it. Mm. She moved as far away from civilization as humanly possible. And Perseus still went there to kill her. And we are supposed to believe that she was in some way a villain.
Like, how did we turn this woman into a villain? Like, that, even when I was a child, I read Medusa's story and I saw all of those interpretations of her on screen. And I just used to be like, why? Like, if you go looking to, like, it's the equivalent of, even the way that is depicted on screen, they always go looking for her. They go looking for a monster to kill, right? And then they act as if they're heroes by killing this monster. Yeah. And I'm just like, you went into something's home and then you tried to kill it, even if it was a monster. Like, so many hero stories are just of these, like, men who just, like, decided, okay, we're just going to go in there into this place. We are not welcome. And we basically, there's a big beware sign in front of it and, like, stay away. But we're going to go in there and we're going to fight that thing and we're going to kill it. And everyone's going to think we're heroes. What?
Yeah. Like, explain what the heroism is in that moment.
I'm telling you. It's one of those things. It's like this very toxic mix of toxic masculinity with colonization. They intersect at so many points. And that's what it is, isn't it? Like, it's because I come from India, colonization is something I think about a lot, you know, because my grandparents were adults at the time when the British left. So they have all these vivid stories. Like, my grandfather told me the story about how there was an orchard, because he lived in Kashmir. So there was an orchard next door to him, and, like, how he used to visit that orchard, and, like, there were white guards. They were, like, British guards that guarded that orchard because it was an orchard that, you know, the British used to take a lot of fruit from and everything. Mm. He talked about how they were, like, a bunch of, like, 12 to 13 year old boys, him and his friends. They were beaten to an inch of their lives for daring to go into the white man's orchard and steal a white man's orchard, which was in our country, in our.
Yeah.
It's a horrific story, and he tells it in such detail. And I look at that and I'm like, that's colonization, isn't it? You go to someone else's land, you go to someone else's home, you take it over, you call it your own, and then the people who are off that land, you villainize them. You turn them into the bad guys, and you beat them and you subhumanize them. And it's just, yeah, I think that's why I identify so much with the monsters in this book, in this book and in Greek myth. All of them.
Yeah.
I love all of them.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way. And that's such a, I mean, for one, that's a horrifying story. And I try to think more and more about colonization in general. I am a white person from Canada, so you know, we've got a lot of shit on our end too, and it's such a dark thing, all of it, but I had never thought of Medusa in that way, and I think that's so valid, but also just like, it's just such a perfect kind of interpretation of her story.
I had started writing a short story for this book about Medusa. Mm. And a lot of stuff didn't make it into this book simply because if everything I had written made it into this book, it would have been about 700 pages long, right? Because I just fell in love with all the stories. I was like, these stories, they're so easy to love these stories, you know?
And they really are.
The thing with the Greek gods and goddesses and all the monsters and everything is that they're so... they're not human, absolutely not, but they're messy. They're so messy, man. Like, they remind us of ourselves because they're petty. It's one of those things where you're constantly sitting over there and you're constantly thinking about all the stories that you heard as a child. And so much of this book is just when my mom read me these stories from the Encyclopedia Britannica. I remember they're really old now. I think they're my grandfather's. And my mom would read me these stories and I'd be like, but why was Zeus so mean to Hera? Why was he so mean to her? What did she ever do to him that he was so mean to her? And my mom would be like, well, she was mean to the people that he was sleeping with. I'm like, but wasn't he married to her? Like, isn't that like wrong? So my mom is like, this is different. You know, it's like in Greece, that was acceptable for a man to do those things, but like it wasn't acceptable. I'm like, mom, that sounds really wrong. You know, because I was like, what, 10? I was like, that just, yeah, it sounds a bit messed up.
That's the thing. And it's, I mean, you're just describing like why I have this obsession with these myths that I do, because they're not human, but what makes them so fascinating is those human characteristics.
Right.
The fact that Zeus is an absolute piece of human garbage, just like just a shitty guy in control of everything. I mean, he's a great sort of symbol for everything. Also sort of, I don't know if I can make the argument this in the vein of colonialism. I think I could, but you know, like he's like the British Empire, you know?
He is. It's what he is.
Yeah.
And what he does to all of those women is no different from colonization. Like just what he did to Europa, man. Come on.
Oh my God. I mean, perfect example. Literally Europe. But like there's a fascinating, and I forget where it's from. It might be Roman, but there's a fascinating extra detail of that story that I found when I covered her more recently. Mm-hmm. That there was somebody who wrote this version where she's visited in a dream by two continents.
Oh.
Asia and this unnamed one.
Mm-hmm.
And Asia is where she's from and holds on to her and says, you know, like, I am your home, or I'm going to forget all the details. But essentially, this dream foretells that either, you know, she's going to stay in her home in Asia that loves her, or this like mysterious continent is going to overtake her.
Oh my
and
God.
Then, yeah. And so I think this is a later story, but I love it.
It's beautiful.
And it's, isn't it? I mean, it fits so well. Obviously, Europe is named for her.
Mm.
But just the idea that she was taken from Asia to become Europe is a dark and fascinating thing.
I really think it
also says a lot about how the ancient Greeks respected Asia Minor as they saw it, you know, like that whole region. I mean, not only did they think that Europa basically like founded Europe from Phoenicia, but they also credit her brother Cadmus for giving them their alphabet. So I think it's fascinating the way they definitely had like a huge amount of respect for not only like, you know, Phoenicia and the whole of what is now kind of modern Turkey, Lebanon area, right, and but also Egypt. I mean, they had this huge respect for Egypt. Cadmus went to Greece and named Thebes for the glory of Egypt. Yeah, like it's a very fascinating thing. They were definitely colonizers too, but it's such a different thing than the British Empire, you know, which was racist. Exactly. Like one had a level of racism that definitely the ancient Greeks were certainly, they had their own kind of version of it, but it wasn't based in color. It wasn't based in skin color. Absolutely. It was based in like whether you spoke Greek. So it was kind of easy to fix.
You know, it's just like you learn the language. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So they were, they were like able to respect people from other regions as long as they kind of spoke Greek. But yeah, this different level of this British Empire coming in, and it's such a Zeus thing. It's just overtaking and destroying everything and just fucking shit up.
Completely. Well, absolutely. Sorry, I'm just swearing up. I find it.
That's not my whole podcast. Don't worry.
I do see like Zeus, like the running joke is like, who's the father of all the fuckboys? And Zeus is like, me, I am the fuckfather. But yeah, I find his and Hera's relationship is very fascinating to me, because as the goddess of marriage, she cannot physically leave him. I wrote a version of the story where she did, because, and I loved writing that story because, when I started researching this book, I had a little bit of empathy towards Hera, but like, I always saw her as the anti-woman's woman, you know, like she was very, she took out all of her temper on Zeus's mistresses and his children. And that, to me, even if you were cheated on, I found it unforgivable until I really started looking into her as like a goddess. And so I wrote this entire play on her because I'm so obsessed with her now. Mm. And it basically is called Maidens, Myths, and Monsters. And it's, you know, she tells the story of Olympus from, you know, the minute they are born, like, and they come out of Kronos, and you see her, why she becomes the way she does, because she was one of Zeus's first victims. Yeah. Right? He turns into, and the thing with that story that always really hurts me, physically hurts me, is the way that he did it, that he turned himself into a cuckoo. He turned himself into one of her favorite, she loved birds, and he used that against her. Oh my God, it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart. And acting that, because it was a one-woman show, and it's like a long poem done over an hour where she tells the whole story.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, so much fun to do, and it was so much fun to like create and to write, and you know, then I did the show, and there were 10 nights that I did it, and people came back to watch it 2 or 3 times, and they were like, oh my God, we want to hate her, but you made it so hard. You've made it so hard because you look at her and you realize that she's a victim of trauma herself, and she hasn't been able to process it. And towards the end, you know, she does get her redemption where she goes, I am so tired of this. I am so tired of him and everything. Like, I'm so tired of being devoured constantly by him, you know, by his stories where he gets to be this affable, lovable scamp, you know, essentially, despite all of the bad things that he does. And I have to be the villain every time. And no one understands my story because I never get to tell it. But yeah. Her story, really, it shook me when I began to really look into her and realize who she was. Oh, yeah, heartbreaking. Heartbreaking stuff, what was done to the goddesses.
Absolutely. Hera's one that I want to dive back into because of everything I've kind of learned, but also sort of developed in my own understanding. Because the thing about her too, I mean, everything that you've just said, but I always go to the ancient sources of it because of the type of nerd that I am. And so for me, I just always go back to like, well, who wrote these stories, right? Mm-hmm. And so with Hera, you know, she is a product of the men who wrote down these stories that survive to us today. Not necessarily the original stories or how everyone in ancient Greece understood her. she's a product of the versions that we have. And in those versions, like, Zeus doesn't, I mean, he's doing things wrong, but it's never presented as if, like, it's actually really harmful in any kind of concrete way. And I think that's because, all for the most part, all the victims are women, except for Ganymede, who, like, gets his place up on Mount Olympus. Like, so it, you know, it's Hera also, and I mean, setting aside who wrote these stories down, Hera presumably couldn't punish Zeus. And she was sort of so overtaken by, like, what you're saying, her own trauma, everything she's experienced being married to the asshole, that, you know, I think she kind of became that sort of patriarchal idea of a woman who will punish the women, because it's that same idea of, like, in all, you know, old TV shows and probably still way too recently, where a guy cheats on his girlfriend and the girlfriend punches the girl or something, you know, where you're like, whose fucking fault is it that your boyfriend cheated? It's not hers. It's absolutely his. And this idea that women will blame other women for something a man does, you know, she's like the first one who ever, like, blamed a woman for a cheating spouse. It's so dark, and, you know, and she couldn't, what could she have done to the king of the gods anyway?
She tried once, didn't she? She tried, and look what happened to her.
Yeah, that's a story that I keep meaning to tell, and I actually, like, meant to jot it down today. I was thinking about it as I was reading, like, rereading some of the poems in Great Goddesses, and I was like, I have never actually told the story of when Hera tried to take down Zeus.
Because people always say, like, why didn't she ever try? She did. She tried, and look what he did to her for trying. Like, who helped him? It was men who helped him. Like, it really frustrates me. It frustrates me because what she did was incredibly brave. It was a mutiny. She knew what would happen because she knew his temper. I'm sorry, I talk about them like they're real people, don't I? But, like, I'm so invested.
So do I.
Yeah, so right? Do I. Like, I'm so invested in those stories because I see there is so much of a reflection of what women actually go through today in those stories, because people want to believe things like, oh yeah, those stories are so ancient, they don't reflect our modern day. Of course they bloody do. Like, the way Medusa is treated as a victim and, like, re-victimized and villainized, same way Hera becomes the evil one, even though her husband is the biggest cheat and, like, assaulter of women. The same way, like, so many of the gods get their nuances the way the goddesses don't. The goddesses Absolutely. Are always petty. The goddesses Yep. are always petty. Even if you're Athena, and Athena was not a girl's girl. But even so, her mistakes are not as easy to forgive as, say, Apollo's mistakes.
I think about Aphrodite a lot in those cases. I've always loved her, and I think she's just kind of still
wonderful.
It's funny, I'm not a person, like, I'm not a romantic person, and still, like, my favorite thing about Aphrodite is that she just said fuck it, and she was just with Ares whenever she wanted, among other men that she, you know, felt like it at the time, but I love that she and Ares have what I consider to be one of the only, like, legitimate romances. In, like, they actually loved each other in a way that there's not a lot of other love stories, love stories in Greek mythology. And yet she couldn't actually be with him, but she was just kind of like, fuck it, I don't like my husband. Everyone can know that I don't like my husband. We're just going to go with it. And I just, she has kind of had this level of freedom that not a lot of goddesses had.
Yeah, and the whole relationship between her and Hephaestus is so interesting to me as well.
Absolutely.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of,
a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I find Hephaestus, I have a lot of love for Hephaestus. Like, one of my friends was like, when I was talking about him, I was writing the poems about him, she was like, you've got to be careful because you're going to end up manifesting a baby. Like, at this rate, you love him a little too much. Like, calm down. And I think it's because I think Hephaestus being this man who works in a forge, and that's all, he loves very few things. Working in the forge and making these beautiful, like, you know, weapons, and, like, especially, like, for Hermes. When Hermes is a baby, I love that story, but Hermes is a baby, and Hephaestus makes him his first little, like, helmet and everything, like, which is, like, very cute. Oh. It's very, very cute. I love it. Like, he's, there's a real kind side to Hephaestus that you see over and over and over again in the myths. And he's the one that's gone through the most, you know? They've, like, thrown him off, like, Olympus. Whether it was Zeus or Hera who did it, depending on which version of the myth you hear, he was thrown off Olympus, and he ends up disabled because of it. But what does he do with that? Like, he comes back, and he manages to come back in the most conniving way, which I think is pretty slick. Pretty slick.
I think we're on different sides of the Hephaestus spectrum.
I think I find him easier to relate to, because I can understand being hated from the minute you are born and carrying that hatred with you. I can identify with that, and I find it very interesting the way, because people either love him or hate him, right? Like, it's he's a very he's a very interesting god, because people either love him or they absolutely don't like him at all. So I'm on that. So we may be on other ends, but I can understand, because I've met people who can't stand him. So,
no, and I don't say I hate him. And I do think he's fascinating. Yeah. Like, I think, and like you said, you know, I mean, I think he's very complex. Mm. He was hated from the beginning, and that is so heartbreaking. Mm. And he was thrown off Mount Olympus, and that is so heartbreaking. Yeah. So personally, I can see why people like him so much, and I can see why they identify with him, and I absolutely find him sympathetic. But I also go to him trying
Kira in the chair.
In a chair.
And I love her. And I still thought that was quite funny. I mean,
the problem, I think, because I think, especially if you're considering her as the one who threw him off Mount Olympus, then I'm kind of like, okay, cool. Like, I think that's a good call on your part. I think the darkness for me is that it results in him, Aphrodite, being
that.
basically tricked and forced into marrying him. So I think my problems with him are based around Aphrodite and not so much based around like his original story. Yeah. Like,
and I love her as well. I find it really hard because I do love all of them independently, and it's because I see them with their nuances, right? I love Aphrodite, and even in the book I write her crying on her wedding day. And the way I've written him is that he says that, don't do this, she won't love me. Don't do this, she won't love me. Oh, but like, there was also the element of Zeus being pressured almost by Hera to marry Aphrodite off, because Aphrodite was really beautiful. And like, all of the gods were like, fans, you know, it basically, in a way, it threatened Hera's beauty as well, didn't it? Because she's a very beautiful goddess as well. And she is jealous. That's fine. She's jealous. So I saw it from, that's the angle I came at it from. And of course, in a book where you're playing and you're telling it in a fictional way, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I always saw it as, that must have been so horrible for everyone involved. For Ares, who was made a god of terrible things. For Hephaestus, who, you know, he didn't deserve a wife who didn't love him. He deserved a wife who would stay with him, right? And for like Aphrodite, who was being forced to marry a man that not only she didn't love, she wasn't attracted to, like in any way. And she's this beautiful goddess. Like, and all of those things come together and they create like the ultimate soap opera, really, don't they?
I mean, there's, that like love triangle / everything that goes on between those three, like, is just the best.
And he can be so spiteful, right? Hephaestus with the chair, with the
the bed, the chains.
Oh my goodness,
I love it. But also, it's so dark.
It's so dark. Like, this is where like the story that I found really hard to rationalize, the story that I was writing. I was like, yeah, but you want him to be this guy who's quite put upon, but he does go and do that, Nikita, you know, like, because you have to question your own, the way you're writing something, right? And I'm like, what if he just waits in your story instead till she finally sees him, you know? What if he just waits? And I was like, yeah, but you're not being very accurate with the myth, are you? And I was like, yeah, but you know, I was like, if I could do it, I'll do it.
Yeah, why not? I don't think there's anything wrong with playing with the myths when it comes to that type of thing. It's actually something that I find myself struggling with, and I want to get better at it. Like, I'm trying to write fiction based on the myths, but
it's hard.
Am so deep in the accuracy.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, and I think it's just especially hard since I have spent these past 4 years of my life, like every waking moment, trying to tell an accurate story. And that's gotten more and more intense for me, especially in the past year. I've become Twitter friends with a lot of classicists. Yeah. And that has like influenced me to be like, oh my God, like, what if I get this thing wrong? And it's totally on me, and it's my own anxieties. But I find, because I'm so obsessed with making the podcast like as accurate as humanly possible, it makes it very difficult for me to play with the stories in a completely separate medium. I'm trying to make it something different. I want to write fiction desperately, and I'm struggling with it so hard, because it's like, I have trouble getting beyond the characters that I know so well from the podcast.
It's really hard. It's really hard. And it's like, when I was writing this book, I went through all of that, but because I haven't, like, I wasn't in it as deep as you are, like, you know, with the accuracy and with the, I read all the books and everything, but I hadn't gone in and spoken to any classicists, you know, I hadn't had that experience. That I did question myself. I did sit over there and I go, you know, there is a version of the story where he tries to rape Athena and he does this and he does that, you know. And I looked at all of that and I'm like, your lovely little Hephaestus isn't as lovely little Hephaestus as you think he is. Because there's that mean little voice that you have to have in your head when you're writing all the time, right? Who's your inner critic, and kind of, and that inner critic's really useful, especially when you're writing about the classics. And it's just like, you've had that argument with yourself where you're like, no, I'm making this decision. I know all of this, but I'm making this decision because I want to tell a certain story. And I want a certain narrative, because with fiction, you have to have a single narrative unless you're writing three or four different perspectives. And this book was like mm-hmm. so many different perspectives, right? And a lot of the gods, like, I feel like I gave a lot of, I even gave Zeus an out, you know, I said, like, you get to choose. Who do you want to be? Do you want to be king of the gods, or do you just want a happy life? Who do you want to be? You know, and every scenario in my head, because writers do that, where they sit the character down and they interrogate the character. Every single one of those scenarios, he chose to be the king of the gods in my head. Everyone, there was no out for him.
I mean, yeah, that's Zeus. You tried, right? Like, you gave him the chance. It's just he's still
can't do anything about it. You give him as many shots as you want, but he doesn't change. There are some parts of his personality that are so set, you know. But even with Aphrodite, like, her core personality is so interesting, you know. She's such a fascinating character.
She really is. I've always just been just very obsessed with her as a character and the things she experiences. And, you know, I don't know what it is about her too. Like, she's fascinating. She's super complex, but there's just something there. I just love it.
I think there's an independence to her, isn't it? There's an independence to her.
Yeah.
It's something you described right at the beginning when we started talking about her. She does what she wants anyway. She flouts what Zeus has put on her. And I think that's what makes her so interesting and such a hero to me. Like a true hero, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, she loves who she wants to love. She does what she wants to do. It's one of those things. It's, you know, she really is like, she's got to be one of the most free and independent of the goddesses. I mean, Athena, I think, wants you to believe that she is, but she's really so obsessed with rules and with being accepted by the gods. And by that, I mean the men, you know?
Oh, she's got daddy issues as well, like major daddy issues.
Huge daddy issues. Yeah, huge issues there. And I think she just wants to be one of the guys. You know, like, dive into what made her that way, either in the stories or in the culture or whatever. But yeah, Aphrodite is just kind of like, no, whatever, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to have a ton of kids with Ares, absolutely none with my husband. And just kind of like be this like icon of sex and beauty. And not, it's not even like she sticks with Aries. Like, I believe she and Aries were actually in love. They're like my couple, if I were to have one. But she's even like, no, but like Adonis is really hot. You know, like I also want him. And there's definitely more I can't think of. But I love that she loves Aries. She doesn't love her husband. But she is also willing. She's like, well, no, I'm not sticking with Aries either. Like, I'm going to have my way. I'm just going to do whatever the hell I want.
Yeah. And Hephaestus is married to his forge, isn't he? He's married to his forge. Let's be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I think he tried for a while, you know. Trapped them in a net, which is
innovative.
Like, it is one of my favorite stories because it is the most absurd and like
it's comical.
It's so funny. And it's also one of the most ancient. It's like the one, it's like Hermes' birth story, where on like his first 3 days of being alive, he kills a turtle, invents the lyre, and then steals Apollo's cows from like all across Greece. And you're like,
and Apollo shows up really pissed off and can't be angry at the baby because it gives him a lyre. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Like, he hides in his crib under the covers trying to get away from Apollo. It's crazy. And then to think that that was written down somewhere in like 700 BC, and you're like, what? Like, I just want to go back and talk to these people so bad and be like, this was your culture, this is your ancient, like, everyone wants to talk about that, this whole ideal of Greece being like, you know, and for better or worse, there's a lot of darkness involved, but the like quote-unquote, you know, founders of Western civilization, which is its own level, we'll say. We're like, they invented democracy and the classic playwrights and the philosophers, they were so brilliant. And then you're like, okay, but in 700 BC, someone was singing about a kid who stole cows from across Greece. Like, or the guy who tried to catch his wife having sex by trapping her and her lover in an invisible net. Like, sure, they also invented democracy, but this came before that. Like,
I just want them to be like, I always picture them like really seriously telling these stories and like getting really pissed off if anyone laughs, because in my head, that's how I see it. Like,
especially when you're talking about the Homeric hymns, like which is where both of those stories originally come from, or that we know of, they would have been sung, you know, like people are probably like traveling around the Hellenic world singing songs of Hephaestus trapping Aphrodite in a net.
Hilarious. It's actually hilarious. Like, and I think that's why we love these stories so much, is because there's elements of like fun in them, isn't there? Like,
yes.
Humor. Like, and you see it a little bit in like Hindu mythology. I think pantheons in general, any religion that has a pantheon of gods. You know, there's Loki in the Norse gods, who I can't even talk about without cracking up because he was up to so much mischief. But any religion with a pantheon, there will be humor and war with that pantheon somewhere or the other. My mum tells the most hilarious version of the Mahabharata ever. And the way that she tells it is so funny, because you're just sitting over there going, what do you mean? And like one of the, she doesn't ever use the characters' names. She just gives them descriptors. So she's like, the evil-scented lady. So I was like, and then the evil-scented lady did this. And then like the poor old man was like this. And I was just like, it's far easier to follow the story, funnily enough, without the names, but like the descriptors instead. But if you hear like my mother's version of the Mahabharata, it's extremely irreverent, but it's so funny. And you're just like, these are our great epics? Really?
The ancient people were amazing. You know, ancient people across all of Earth had these incredible stories. I want to learn more about the indigenous stories of Canada. It's hard to find because we have the British Empire really did kind of drill them all into the earth and hide everything. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, like all these ancient cultures had all these stories to tell. And it was, I mean, it was their version of TV, right? It was like these, these like oral stories where you're just kind of like, someone's just going to sit in front of a fire and listen to this bard tell you this absolutely bananas story about the gods. And it's just so, it's just so magnificent. And it's interesting you're saying the way your mom tells the stories of with the descriptors, because I mean, that's basically how those old stories in Greece were told too, right? Where, you know, it was always like, Aphrodite is the Cyprian goddess or the Catharian goddess, right? It's that, or the Thracian god would be Ares, and like all these things where you're not necessarily using the name, but you're using this thing about them that reminds people who you're talking about. And I think that it was a part of the oral tradition of just like learning it that way, because you're not reading it, you're not seeing that name. And so I think it's easier to remember the name once you're seeing it. But when you're just listening, I think that's kind of the best way of telling those stories, is that if you use those descriptors. And so clearly your mom is just like a, you know, basically a Homeric bard.
well, you know, the Hindus, like my mom's Hindu, my dad's Sikh, but like the Hindus believed in reincarnation, right? So I bet she must have been like somewhere thousands of years ago, she was a bard telling these stories.
She was a Hindu bard just traveling around and telling these ancient stories.
I love that idea as well, like the idea that we've all been here before. And like when I wrote The Girl and the Goddess, so I did Great Goddesses, and then I've done The Girl and the Goddess, and I did an entire novel in verse with like the nine versions of Shakti, which are the nine versions of the goddess, basically visiting this child. And kind of, you know, as she's growing up in modern day, and you know, the story of reincarnation appears again and again and again, and you know, the whole story of like the Ramayan shows up in the book, and Draupadi, who's, you know, one of the main female characters in the Mahabharata, tells the story of the Mahabharata, but only in nine pages. So like nine pages for that, now nine pages for the Ramayana, and the whole thing is told, and it has to be somewhat magical, right? I find it really interesting because Indian people have loved the book. They have, by and large, loved the book. A few people from the West have loved the book, but a lot of the book also deals with calling out colonization. And you know, one thing this book has really done for me is like, I can really see the type of person who reads my work and doesn't really want to see the me talk about my own culture. Yeah. It's really interesting. Like some of the reviews I've got on this book or some, like I even got like a few DMs and emails where people are like, why don't you stick to writing about fairy tales and Greek myths instead of writing about like Indians? I love it when people say Indians as if like I'm not an Indian myself and they don't realize how racist they're being when they say that. It's really funny.
That's so dark. You, an Indian woman, stick to the Greeks, would you? What are you doing diving into your own mythologies and cultures? Like, what?
So, my father's family, like, they're actually... So, our tribe actually did come from Greece. Like, the Jersey community in general, we did come from Greece. And we settled in, you know, what's now Punjab and everything. And because there's so much casteism, that the tribe didn't really marry outside of the tribe. They, you know, they stuck within the community. So it's just really interesting because my father has been able to trace his family line back to Greece.
Wow.
And everything, which is very cool. Like, it just, it's very interesting to see that we actually came from there. And which would, like, explain my, like, obsession with the Greek myths to a certain extent as well. Yeah. Because it's all about, like, your roots, right? Where do you come from? All of us spend our whole lives, in a way, trying to figure out where we came from and to deal with the trauma of what we're given. The Chthonic goddesses as well, there's so much to them, you know, like Styx and Hecate and even Persephone later on. And I love the idea of like Hecate kind of being quite protective of Persephone, or Corea, she's becoming Persephone, right? Like I love the idea of like women giving other women the power to survive in these terrible... I love it. I love it all. And maybe I'm making it all up in my head, but like in my head, I see Styx doing the same for Hecate. You know, like it just, it's like a tradition of women, like giving other women this power to survive anything in a world of patriarchy and men who control everything. But do they? Do they really?
Not.
Or is
they
it the
do
women?
Not. Yeah. I've been thinking more and more lately about like what stories that must have been told that we don't have. Which I think about all the time, but lately just in terms of the women's stories and like what they must have told each other or their children or whoever.
Oh yeah.
That we don't have. You know? Like that I would kill to know what real myths were told by the matriarchs, you know, were told by the women who really did control the whole household. They just never wrote them down, or if they wrote them down, they didn't survive.
Yeah. I kind of wish there were more stories about Hestia, for instance. I think she's such an interesting goddess.
And so important. So important. Mm. You know, she was completely vital to the ancient Greek home. She was everything. And yet, we don't have stories of her, which is fascinating. I kind of just picture her as just being so over it. You know, like, I'm just way too good for your Olympian drama. Like, you know, I'm leaving the Real Housewives of Olympus and I'm just going to be where I'm needed. And that's, like, in every ancient Greek person's home. Like, I like to just imagine her just, like, over their shit. And that's why we don't have anything about her.
I literally picture her. This is so off track and it has nothing to do. I have no evidence for something like this at all. It's just in my head. I see it. Like, you know, Hestia just getting sick of Zeus's bullshit. And like as she's leaving, hands Prometheus the fire and says, go on, do it.
Oh, I
dare you.
I like that. I feel like that's canon in my head now. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's because as a fiction writer, you kind of, if you can find a way to justify it, especially with a goddess like Hestia, because there's not a lot out there about her.
Yeah, you can justify anything about her.
Basically.
Yeah.
Because there isn't so much out there about her. You can just take it and go, what if I just do this?
I love that. I like it. I mean, it takes power away from Prometheus, gives it to a woman. That's A plus. But also just that she was kind of like, nah, fuck you. Like, here you go.
I feel like she's far more, I wish, like you said, we have the stories.
Yeah.
But we don't have any of the stories of the matriarchs. We just have to excavate what we do have. And what we do have is a lot of patriarchal stories told by men, retold by men, and then translated also majority by men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really nice to have like Emily Wilson's translation. Because it switched everything around, didn't it?
It absolutely did. I love that translation so much. And I know she's working on the Iliad and I'm excited for it. And
I just think what's really funny is that you've shared a few reviews that you get sometimes of the show. And like there are men in the comments or in the reviews who are just like, she seems to hate men. And I'm like, she's just telling the stories as they're written. Like, I'm sorry men come off badly. Maybe they should have behaved better.
That's the thing. Every time I get reviews like that, I'm like, so what I say is rape is bad. And what you hear is she hates all men. And I just think, you know, you are telling on yourself. You are really, really telling on yourself.
It makes me laugh so much.
Yeah, it's hilarious and horrifying. But I love sharing those ones. The ones that are just so absurd and so obviously based in misogyny.
Yeah.
I've literally never once implied that all men are bad or that I hate all men. It's the not all men thing, obviously. You know, it's that.
Yeah.
It's that, like, men, they can recognize what they have done in the things they hear, and therefore they think you're blaming all men. And I'm like, well, then it's because you've done something shitty.
Yeah, that's a you problem.
Yeah, like you're recognizing something shitty. Like, I mean, it's the same thing with like white people who can't handle criticism of white people. You know, not all white people. Like, no, white people are by and large really awful. Colonialism is on us. Like, it's the same fucking thing. And if you can't recognize that, then it just means you're like identifying in it with it in this way that you absolutely can't wrap your head around. Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh my God. Thank you for saying this, because it does. I did a performance of Great Goddesses a while back. And I specifically chose poems about Zeus, you know, like the hero poem, Hera Invented the Rain poem. I wrote, like, there were like a few poems I chose, and I guess both Zeus and Poseidon come off quite badly.
They're bad.
In my book.
They're bad.
Because
it's not you.
Because they do bad things.
It's not just
exactly
you. Like, Poseidon is the secret worst.
Oh, he is. He's worse than Zeus in many ways. Like, in many ways. And he gets away with it. I don't understand why. But yeah, there was this man in the audience at the end of my show when I said, you know, any questions and answers, I'm like open to any. Which is always a mistake.
dangerous.
But this guy is like, I have one. Why do you hate men so much? In a crowd. Like, usually they try to hide it or something.
But he was a white man, right?
Yeah. he stood up and he was just like, why do you hate men so much? And I was like, I'm literally talking about the Greek gods. And I talked two very specific Greek gods were not good in this book. And in the poems which I chose to read, where did you get, yeah, I hate all men when you heard that? Because if you identify that much with Zeus and Poseidon, I hate to tell you,
yeah,
but the problem's you.
Yeah.
And later on, he bought two copies of Great Goddesses for his daughters. Mm. And he told the lady who was organizing the event, because she wouldn't really let him come to talk to me again, because she was like, oh God, like, what's going to happen? Bless her for trying to protect me, basically. But he basically said he was going through a divorce, and maybe like he just kind of blew up a little bit because he thought he took it very personally. And I looked at that and I was like, these are fictional stories.
Yeah.
How did he like come for a Greek mythology thing and think that Zeus or Poseidon were going to come out well in that? Like, I'm sorry, he's going through a divorce. That must be horribly painful. But attacking a female author for... I'm going through a divorce, so I decided to like attack the first woman who talked badly about...
about rapists.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's all you and I do is literally tell it like it is. And men get furious.
So angry.
Yeah, it's baffling. It's really baffling. I mean, and I think that it's so important that we do tell the versions like that because, like, it is not a feminist interpretation to say that Zeus and Poseidon were rapists. That's not feminism. Certain aspects of what I think both of us do is feminism.
Yeah.
But that is not. It's a simple recitation of the stories while using accurate terminology. And the key is accurate terminology. We're not saying carried off or wrapped away. You know, it's such a bizarre thing, the way people hold on to these ideas.
So bizarre, but it speaks a lot about rape culture today, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And how intrinsically tied up with masculinity it is, like the concept of masculinity and the concept of rape culture and how closely they intersect with each other. We're not even going to get into like how homoerotic like straight man culture is, because that will really trigger people. But you can go looking into it, and it's like, I've been having so many conversations with like my younger friends, you know, who really started getting into like feminist theory and learning about it. And like so many of them ask me this question. They're like, do you think straight men like women? Like, do you think they actually like women? And I'm like, why would you say that? And my friends would say, you know, like the amount of men that we've dated who seem to be dating us, but like they will ditch us for the boys. They will go out with the boys. They will make fun of us in front of the boys, but they will sleep with us. I find that really interesting. Like they start to veer down that road. It's like, do you even like women, or do you just like sleeping with women? That's like,
well, and it's like predatory nature is so wrapped up in straight man culture. Mm. It's just like that. Predatory talk and actions and all these different things. It's so, yeah, it's such a dark and weird thing.
It's all dark and weird, you're right.
It is. And I always come back to that whole like existence, really, like of straight, cisgendered straight men.
Yeah, cisgendered straight men, sorry.
Yeah, no, I know, and I often try to say that earlier, but you know, I think that's obvious when we're talking about these things, especially because what I'm going to say is I always come back to this when I hear these nonsensical ideas of trans people being threatening to anyone. What? And it's like, do you know who is the threat? It's cisgendered men, primarily cisgendered white men.
Yeah.
They are the threat. And the idea that anyone can convince me that there's any kind of real threat in trans people living their fucking lives like they need to, it's just beyond me. It's so crazy.
You know, it's so nice to talk about this because transphobia is one of the things that is making me most nervous about this country right now.
Yes, Britain is terrifying right now. Oh my God.
The way they treat trans people in this country is horrifying. It is horrifying. It scares the crap out of me because this is the country of like where they had basically made it like illegal for years and years for any kind of material about being gay or you know, bi or anything could even exist. Like you weren't allowed to teach it in schools. It wasn't allowed to exist basically. So if you were gay in this country, you really struggled. Like they basically punished their war hero, Alan Turing, in this country by chemically castrating him. Like, and that was the man that won them the war, right? He was the guy who broke the code that won them the war. That's how they treat their war heroes for being gay. Now it's turned onto trans people and the way that they're treating. I'm so worried for my visible trans friends. Because the amount of transphobia online, like if I ever say anything pro-trans online, the amount of shit I get, and like I'm called a misogynist, which is laughable, which is like...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, it's like you have these TERFs coming in and saying that you're not a feminist because you're supporting trans people. And it's like, I don't think you fucking know what the word means.
Yeah,
like, I don't...
Yeah. It's such a marginalized community, and it is infinitely hard to be trans in a world that constantly rejects you for being trans and for just living your most honest truth in the body that feels most comfortable to you. It is so hard. Yeah. And like, nobody wants to put themselves in their shoes and see what's going on. It's so frustrating and it's so annoying. Like, and you can't talk sense to these people. You can't sit and talk sense to herbs. It's impossible. They're just there sitting over there going, no, but trans people are taking women's places. And I'm just like, what? How do you even come to that? Yeah. Like, where has that even come from? Like, how is your womanhood being threatened by a trans woman? I don't understand.
Yeah. And they'll find that single anecdote of one thing happening and being, and it's like, well, this is what's happening. You're like, no, that you can't use that as a all trans people thing. Like, you can't. It's horrifying.
Yeah, these are the same people who will say, who get very upset if you say all women are like this, or all cis women are like this. And you're like, well, if you have a problem with that, why don't you have a problem with using the all trans people are like this? It's just, it's such a weird mentality. And it's like, you are on the wrong side of history is what I keep wanting to say to them.
Oh, absolutely. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous. And I think that's what's so important and often not brought up quite as loudly, is like, this kind of rhetoric is dangerous. Like, it's going to cost people their lives.
It has.
Yeah, exactly.
It's this. It's also like, you know, my last straw with these people, where I get to the point with TERFs where I'm just like, you really don't get it, especially when they're from the queer community. When you see people within the queer community, like the anti-trans, I literally sit over there and I go, it wasn't so long ago when people, and it's still happening, where people think that you should not have the same rights as a straight person does, that you shouldn't exist. And now you're doing it to another community. How dare you?
Yeah, that's, it's so beyond.
It really disturbs me. It really disturbs me because as a, you know, I grew up in a country where being queer, it was absolutely not only a political thing, it was an illegal thing. It was only in 2018 that we got rid of the article that was used to stigmatize the entire queer community in India. Growing up as a bisexual woman, you didn't have anyone to talk to about it. You couldn't talk to anyone about it because you would be stigmatized for it, but you could also be arrested for it. Growing up with that and seeing something like that happen to another community, like their rights of being like, especially like the medical rights being taken away from trans children.
Yes.
That really, I sat and I cried for hours like after that happened, because it is, how can you do that to trans kids? How can you, like, how why are you terrorizing children?
Yeah.
Why are you terrorizing people, but children? Why children?
Yeah. What kind of benefit does it give to anyone else to take? Like, it's just, you can't explain it. It's all just based in just complete hatred.
It is.
Just pointless hate.
It's fascist. You're taking away the medical rights of a community based off anything, their sexuality, their religion, their, you know, race. That's fascism. That's literally the definition of it. Like their orientation, you know, what gender they identify as. You're taking the rights away of an entire community that identifies a certain way. What other descriptor is there for that?
Yeah.
And that's what's really hard to explain, because people are like, no, it's not fascism. Show me how it's not.
Yeah.
And all these ancient stories that we read and ancient cultures that we read about, a lot of them are a lot more sexually liberated than we are today. Mm-hmm.
My favorite stories are all the volume, at least in Greek mythology alone, where they understood trans people. And they told stories that basically, it was like the gods, you know, fixed them. Mm-hmm. Like, this person was born a man, but she knew she was really a woman. And so a god made her a woman.
Yeah.
And I think it's so beautiful, and also shows that they fully understood the concept of being transgender.
Absolutely.
And they were like, cool, well, we get it. Like, clearly you're not in the right body, and so when you're not in the right body, like, the only thing that can solve it is a god. Perfect. Yeah, here you go, you know. They understood it in a way that no one, or that is so hard to get across to people now, where it's just like, they were born in the wrong body. I don't know how else to phrase it. You know, like, The ancient Greeks got it. Why can't we?
Well, it's the same with Hinduism. Like, all of our main three gods, the Trimurti, all had female forms as well. So they had their masculine forms, and then they also had their feminine forms. And Vishnu's feminine form is one of the most well-known. That's Mohini. And he actually went and had children in that form with, like, other male gods. And I find that really interesting. Like, there's so many, like, sexuality is so fluid in, like, the ancient Hindu scriptures that you read. And you're looking at that and you're like one of my favorite characters from The Girl and the Goddess was one of the major characters in the Mahabharata. And his name is Shikhandi. And Shikhandi was, you know, born in the wrong body originally. He was born female, like, but he basically over the story becomes like goes into what his natural body is, which is male. And he's one of the most powerful and most brilliant warriors in the Mahabharata. This trans man.
That's amazing. That's so cool.
And I looked at that and I'm like, how do our ancient scriptures get it? But we don't.
Yeah.
How have we gone this far backward? I don't understand. Like, because progress, we are supposed to be progressive, right? We're supposed to be living in one of the best times in history or whatever, but we don't seem to understand sexuality or gender or orientation or the difference between sex and gender. We don't understand those basic things as a whole.
And I think the way people can communicate now too over the internet and everything just means that all those ideals can become like so much more dangerous and visceral and loud and
because
I mean, certainly in the past like couple of hundred years it's been the same, but you couldn't scream about it to everyone so easily.
The last 10 years has been a revelation, hasn't it, in just how bigoted even the people you I swear it's been like so many heartbreaks. And for me, the anti-trans rhetoric in this country has been so scary because I know people like, and I've seen people who I used to respect until they turned around and they said something horribly transphobic. And like, I'm just like, I can't respect you or know you anymore. Like, I can't.
It's because it's dangerous. I'm constantly dealing with the fact that at the beginning of the podcast, I praised J.K. Rowling because she didn't say that stuff. She didn't think it, or she just didn't say it. But when I was recording those episodes, it wasn't a thing.
No, it wasn't.
And the thing about podcasts is that they live on always, and that's fine. But people really don't like look at what they're listening to. So they don't look and see like, hey, maybe this woman recorded this before J.K. Rowling was a horrifying TERF. And so every once in a while I always want to like make clear how I feel, but then I still have people who like don't follow me on social or like I've said it in later episodes, but I can't guarantee they're going to hear it. And the number of people that I'll post something, they're like, oh my God, thank God, I thought you were a TERF. Or somebody left me a review recently that actually bothered me because it was like, this podcast is great. She's really awesome. She has really awesome feminism except for praising the TERF. And I'm like, well, you just said all those nice things about me and my feminism, and maybe, just maybe, the TERF wasn't a TERF when I praised her. You know, like, and maybe take that into consideration before. And granted, it was a 5-star review. Like, I'm not complaining about that, but it bummed me out because they couldn't figure it out on their own that maybe they were listening to something from an earlier time.
Some of the top-selling children's book authors in this country right now are racist. Or transphobic, even, you know.
Transphobic.
And you're just looking at that and you're going, so 50 years down the line, I'm hoping 50 years down the line, we don't have transphobia. Like, I'm hoping, or if it exists, people are ashamed of it. You know what I mean? And they know it's wrong and they aren't so loud and proud about it. Like, oh my God.
Hello, I'm just popping in here now from the editing stage of this podcast. In between where this last conversation that I've just cut from and our goodbyes, our conversation continued. It got a little bit more personal and just a bit less relevant to the podcast. So I am not including those sections right now, but what that means is that what you're about to hear are little wrap up of goodbyes and whatnot does not suit how we just ended that conversation, which was obviously very serious. I also debated ending it on that conversation about transphobia today and transgender issues. I know it's a bit of a downer to an otherwise more upbeat episode, but I wanted to make sure it stayed in there because I think it's important to talk about these issues as much as possible. I mean, I know, you know, we're not experts on the subject, but at the same time, I think it's important to voice these feelings and thoughts around it, as well as talking openly about how horrific transphobia is, how dangerous, all of that. So I wanted to make sure that it didn't get cut out. And so with that explanation, you're going to return to me from a later time in our conversation where I am mid-laugh. This has been so much fun. I'm so thrilled that we got to talk about your book, Great Goddesses, but also your other book, The Girl and the Goddess. And
that's a novel in verse. It's a really interesting format. So yeah.
Yes, that's fascinating. I'll have to pick that one up too. But thank you. Thank you so much. Such a fascinating episode, chat, everything. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to do this with me. I'm still so thrilled.
I agree. I'm thrilled that we have met in this way. Ugh, nerds, thank you all so much for listening. I hope you appreciate the kind of little bits of choppiness there, because every time it got a little choppy, it was just because she and I went on to talk about so much. Basically, we're friends now. It was amazing. I'm so incredibly thrilled that I got to talk to Nikita all about these fascinating topics, really go into things that I don't often look at, or I wish I could, but it needs that kind of conversational tone. So I'm just thrilled that we had the opportunity to record this episode, and I absolutely hope to have her on again, because I think that these are conversations that need to be had, and I'm thrilled to be able to share it with you all today. So I really hope you all enjoyed this episode, and thank you all so much for listening. Also, we talked for 2 straight hours, and I ended up forgetting to ask her what she might have wanted to plug or where you can follow her. So I just recommend you buy all of her books and you find Nikita Gill on whatever your social media of choice is. She is fancy and verified and easy to find. Highly recommend. She posts her poetry on her Instagram and has an incredible Twitter account. So please follow her in both of those places if you are not already. So I always say thank you to you guys, but today I'm giving kind of an extra big thank you because every once in a while I get to kind of look around and see what my life has become from this podcast. And obviously it is all because of you nerds who come here twice a week to listen to me either ramble on by myself about these incredible stories or talk to incredible people like Nikita Gill, amongst all of the other incredible authors and classicists and just specialists that I've talked to recently. It's kind of mind-blowing, and I'm so incredibly grateful to all of you for it. So thank you all so much. You are all magnificent. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.